What's up, everyone? Welcome to the Bronx Pinstripe Show, episode 290. This is Christmas Eve as it's being released. Scott, Merry Christmas. Are you in the holiday spirit?
I'm trying to be. I'm really trying to get in the holiday spirit. We're recording this a couple days early because I'm going to be traveling. But once again, my wife, who's the kindergarten teacher, brought home some awesome bugs to the family, and pretty much our entire household was hunched over a toilet at some point today or this week, and nailed me on Friday. So we're all trying to like regroup and get back into it. Lots of holiday music, lots of like Christmas music, old school, just to get our minds right and see if we can get back into this thing. So we're getting there.
I feel like teachers, especially kindergarten teachers, must have some of the strongest immune systems out there because they're just exposed. It's like they are these scientists who are experimenting with like diseases back in the 80s, like during the Cold War. Like that's the type of shit that they're exposed to. So their immune systems must be pretty strong.
Well, I think the majority of them are, but the problem with my wife Bevan is that she was working at like their central office for a while, and she went back to the classroom so that she could spend more time with Kemp during the day. So she's back to the classroom as like a newbie almost. So I think the immune system has you know, taken a couple of years off, and it's like, oh, all right, I can hang out now, right, and then get thrown back into the kindergarten or like, boom, overload. And
there's new mutations now. Yeah, she's been out of the game for a few years and some things have evolved.
And we're all really, you know, reaping the benefits of this. So, but I think it takes a while for that immune system to get built up. So, you know, by the time she's no longer teaching kindergarten again, she'll be good.
Yeah, that's so kindergarten teachers, the scientists, and also riding the subway in New York City. Those are the three places where you can really build up that immune system. But have you, so you're going up to Jersey for the holidays, right? See some family?
We will be in Jersey and in New York for about 2 weeks, give or take. And yeah, doing all sorts of fun things, hanging out with the family. It'll be a big difference. Last year we were obviously, you know, with Kemp, we were in the hospital up in Boston. So this will be a big difference, and Kemp will be able to spend Christmas out with his cousins. And so hopefully we all heal up today and we can hit the road. So we're looking forward to it. It's going to be a lot of fun.
Very good. Speaking of hitting the road, March 15th and 16th, St. Patrick's Day weekend in Tampa for Yankee spring training. We are locked in for that weekend. You tweeted out some information about the game event that we're going to be doing on Saturday. Some people have DM'd you that are interested. We have like 40-ish tickets for that.
Yeah, we could probably get some more of that, but we're probably limited to close to 50. That's probably where we're going to be capping it, I'd say around there. We have about 30 to 35 people who are said to be getting tickets right now. So we're approaching that deadline. So it's going to be one of those things where we kind of just have to see how many they have available. And I'm just purchasing, you know, as many tickets as I think people want to go. So right now we're about 35 to 50. If we need to expand it, we might be able to go a little bit higher, but it's not going to go too much higher, I can tell you. So if you are interested in going to spring training and that date works out for you, it's a great time to go because the Yankees play the Red Sox on that Friday, and then they have another home game, which will do the event on Saturday. So there's a back-to-back days in Tampa, and there's not very many of those, so it's a good weekend to go. Plus it's St. Patrick's Day weekend, so a lot of fun things happening with you know, everything going on in Tampa. It's a good weekend to do it. So if you do want to go, shoot me a DM or shoot us an email. You can info@bronxpinstripes.com, but I wouldn't wait because the tickets will not be around very long.
You excited to drink some green beer?
Dude, I've retired from green beer.
It's just regular Bud Light with food coloring. You know that.
Yeah, but you know what? It makes you go to the bathroom and you're like shitting camouflage at that point. It looks I can't handle it anymore. So no, I'll just go with like a nice stout. I don't normally drink stouts, but I will on St. Patrick's Day.
Okay. Quick rundown of the BP Crew regular season events. We have 5 events this year.
Yep, they are April 13th versus the White Sox, May 31st versus the Red Sox. That's a Friday game. That's the only Friday game that we'll be doing. The rest are Saturday. June 22nd versus the Astros. July 20th versus the Colorado Rockies. And then August 31st, which is against the Oakland Athletics. And all really good games. Who knows what the White Sox look like by that point. Could be a nice offensive day for the Yankees. Or could be a slugfest. Who knows? And then the rest of them are all going to be, you know, contended games for sure. So lots of good matchups. And, you know, we have a lot of tickets available for that. We're sitting in section 205. These will be on sale
very early this year. So they will, you want to make your plans, and we're having a, if you want to get a season pass for all of these games, that will also be available. So make plans for that. The regular season games don't go on sale for Yankees for another couple weeks. So
yeah, maybe the White Sox will have Manny Machado. He was one of the teams that,
it's possible.
That he met with.
You know, it's funny because he actually talked about the fact that he's not making his decision now, right? Until
the after the new year.
Which gives what? It gives Alonso more time to talk him into going to the White Sox. Spending time with family. His brother-in-law now plays for the White Sox.
Yep.
A lot of things happening there.
Hey, unless those talks involve $300-plus million, I don't think the White Sox are really in contention for
Manny
Machado.
I'm just saying, he's got more time now. More time.
Money's going
to talk him into it.
Also, we've been teasing it for a couple weeks now, but today on the back half of this episode is the Joe Torre Curveballs Along the Way movie review that we did a crossover episode with the Take Two podcast. We had the A-Rod 30 for 30 movie review a few weeks ago. So check this one out if you have watched, or even if you have not watched. It's a nice little memory, trip down memory lane of the 96 season. Fun movie. Funny movie for all the wrong reasons, so I encourage you to check it out. All right, the big news. Manny Machado and the Yankees met on Wednesday, and that sent Yankees Twitter into a buzz.
Yeah, a frenzy, if you will. I don't think it was as big of a frenzy as it was when Corbin was here, probably because Corbin was the first one. And you know, we have the same picture up on the stadium.
It's so dumb. I find it so dumb. it's like a free agent... who is going to be signing for hundreds of millions of dollars is going to be swayed because their frigging face is photoshopped into that team's uniform on the Jumbotron.
It's not the fact that they're swayed. It's almost one of the standard things you have to do now. It's just, this is what it would look like. This is how everything is. It's just a way for them to immerse themselves in the situation. Coming up to bat, Manny Machado, I bet they had the whole thing going. And then you got your face up there. It's, you know, it's just part of the process. It's not like it's a thing that's going to sway them.
So did they have like the PA announcer from Yankee Stadium record something? Now batting for the Yankees, number 13, Manny Machado. You think they'd give him number 13?
See, that I don't think they would. I don't think they would either.
Unless A-Rod said,
I have no problem with it, but I don't think they would.
Well, unless A-Rod said, well, because you know A-Rod's probably going to get his number retired at some point.
Maybe. Maybe. If they'll keep him around long enough. It's possible. I mean, there's been a lot of numbers retired, so certainly it's very possible.
They're gonna have to go to triple digits.
Yeah. But I think it's just part of the process getting him in there. And yeah, I guarantee we had some live people in there. It wasn't even just recordings. We had PA. Everything was live. We're just gonna do all this stuff. We're gonna give him the full treatment and see what happens. But again, 90 minutes, right?
Yeah, people were freaking out.
Maybe they're not signing him. 90 minutes.
Yeah. Why was it so short? He met with the White Sox all day. What the hell? I mean, he also did go out to dinner. Apparently, the dinner lasted 3+ hours. Beltran was there, the newest Yankee special advisor. I don't think A-Rod was there.
CeCe was there during the day, right? That's what we had heard. He was at the facilities when Machado was there. So there's a bunch about that and the fact that CeCe was conveniently there. And I know he works out there during the offseason as well. And, you know, with the news coming up, maybe he was there to see a doctor or some
sort. See the doctors. He probably was, to be honest.
Yeah, but there's, you know, the fact that it was 90 minutes means absolutely nothing to me. Look,
no.
The Yankees and Machado really don't have much to say to each other that's new. They know each other very well. The Yankees know Machado very well from his days in Baltimore, obviously, and then vice versa. Manny Machado knows damn well who the Yankees are and everything that comes with Yankee Stadium. He's played there a ton of times, so there's not much to be gained as far as new information.
Right. So, what do you think was discussed in those 90 minutes?
I think it was more of let's shake some hands, let's make some like real introductions, some formal introductions. Show him, a tour of the facility, a tour of all the things that he would be, that he would use. Probably go on the field and just see some of the new things with the pictures and all that crap. But I think it was just very general. Probably I doubt they even talked any numbers. I think it was more of like we're interested in you. We're interested in the whole process, and then we'll talk about it more at dinner, which is a less formal setting, which I think you can know somebody a lot more informally, which usually goes further, in my opinion.
Well, so, I mean, maybe numbers weren't discussed in that 90-minute meeting, but I guarantee you numbers have been discussed between the two teams at this point, especially because Machado said he's not making his decision until after the new year. So that must mean he has some idea of what each team is going to offer, whether it's years or total dollars.
So I do think that there were numbers discussed at some point, but you know, in that 90-minute meeting, I have a hard time believing that they even really.
No, there's no situation where Cashman is writing a number on a piece of paper and sliding it over the meeting. Like, that's not happening in that 90-minute meeting.
So I think the agent and Cashman have probably had discussions even before this, and you know, maybe after this, but there were this 90-minute meeting is all about Machado and the Yankees and them saying, you know, we're very interested. You know, identifying possibly how they would use him if he were to come over. I could see that being talked about, you know, with the whole Didi situation, because that's very much on the front of the conversation. Where are you going to play? But I think the rest of it, you know, is more about, hey, we're the Yankees. We want to win. We think you'll help us win. And that's, you know, set the stage for that type of thing. Because if they're not going to be the highest bidder, which it sounds like they may not be, you need to sell everything else. You need to sell the Yankees and the fact that, you know, you're in New York, you can also make a ton of money off the field. I'm sure things like that were talked about. So, you know, I think more of a general scene setting was the direction of that meeting.
Is that really, though? I have a hard time, especially like a player like Machado, who's going to be signing for $250+ million. Is the whole endorsements off the field, the whole publicity thing, like, how much does that play a factor at that point?
It should play a major factor. That's a significant amount of money.
But he can do these endorsements, whether he's in New York or whether, like, endorsements now, you don't need to be in New York to do endorsements.
No, that's true. But there's also a whole bunch of stuff that comes with New York. There are certain cities that I think it does matter. But yes, you're right. The whole general
with Robbie Cano going to Seattle, like Seattle's not New York. We figured that out.
But the whole general landscape of having an endorsement and getting because of social media and because of the reach of digital today, it doesn't matter as much where you are. But there are certain cities like Chicago, New York, LA, you know, Miami, probably I think they do make a difference because you could do a lot locally as well. You could do a lot of revenue for the player locally too.
Yes. And in a city, so the cities that he met with, Philly and Chicago, both big baseball towns, both love the White Sox and the Phillies. He would be the man on those teams. He would be the main attraction. He will not be the main attraction on the Yankees. He would probably be third or second.
If you're not first, it doesn't matter.
Right.
And Judge's your collection.
First. We learned Judge is the number one. When Stanton came over here, it was, well, who's going to be the man, Stanton or Judge? It's clearly Aaron Judge. It's his team. It's not even a question. Right. So does Machado care about that?
That's the question. I mean, we don't know. I think we don't know, right? I don't think anybody knows. Everybody, people could speculate in how the guy acts. I mean, there's been so much tearing down Manny Machado over the past 6 months
Series
because of his comments and all this, you know, things that were taken, you know, as they were in the moment and people just blew up with them. I personally don't think that's who he is as a player. We've never really heard much of that before this World Series. So I think things were just kind of blown up and, you know, I got nothing from that guy is telling me that he's not a team guy. And again, I'm not looking at just small little sample size things. I'm looking at the entire scope of who Manny Machado is. And for as long as we've known him, we've known he's a great baseball player. At third base when he was with the Orioles for the most time, he's probably the best, if not one of top two or three best third basemen in the game. And we've never really heard any problems with him at all off the field. So
no,
I kind of dismiss the rest of it.
Every story that's come out about him being a teammate has been positive.
Yes.
Teammates like him. And Buck Showalter has talked on the radio. I listened to a segment he did with Michael Kay, and he said that he never had an issue with Machado in the clubhouse. And that the whole hustling down to first base thing or whatever is something, yes, you're going to have to deal with Machado, but he also is durable and he plays 160+ games.
Yeah, whatever. I don't know. I have a hard time taking, it's like, you know, you throw out the low and you throw out the high and you just take the mean. And what is that? The majority of the things that we've seen is him being a very good baseball player all over the field and a good dude off the field. I mean, even the most recent article that I read about him and Jonathan Scope when Scope got traded. You know, I mean, Machado, he called him up. He went over there. He went over to his house. And you know, it seems like he takes time and has personal relationships with a lot of these guys. I mean, look, how many of the Yankees were generally courting him at the All-Star break, essentially? You saw all the pictures in the All-Star dugout. Yeah, Judge got the thing on third base.
That was from spring training. Was the Judge thing last spring training where he said Machado would look good in pinstripes?
It was early in the season. I don't think it was during spring training. I thought it was early in the season. I think it was one of the early April matchups. But then at the All-Star break, you know, the pictures of all the guys on the All-Star team for the Yankees sitting around Machado. Like, you know, there's no problem there. I don't know why everybody is. I tweeted that out. I said the thought that he is a problem in a clubhouse and that he's going to be an issue, and because of all these, the fact that he doesn't hustle, like, that whole theory and narrative is actually the lazy narrative, because you're not going beyond one thing that he said or two things that he said. Look at the whole body of work. That's where the true story is.
Maybe part of that 90-minute meeting was talking to trying to gauge how he would handle not being the main attraction on the team.
Maybe, but I don't know if you want to sell that in a meeting where you're trying to sign somebody.
You're not. Well, but part of this stuff for Cashman and the Steinbrenners, when they're going to be spending so much money on a player, you have to do your due diligence. You have to try and understand how that player is going to react to the environment. You're not going to invest almost $300 million in somebody if you do not think they're going to be a success in your organization. And they have to be realistic about it. They have Aaron Judge, who is their most marketable and most beloved player. That's not going to change as long as he is on the field. Doesn't matter Manny Machado, Bryce Harper. Doesn't matter who they bring in. They could bring in Mike Trout. I'm serious. Aaron Judge would still be more popular because he's the homegrown guy.
No, you're right. And you know, that's an interesting thought. I think to put that out in the front, I could see Cashman doing that now that we're talking about it, just being very blunt and honest. Like, this is the situation. This is where we are. This is what we've seen. We brought over a MVP from the National League, and he still couldn't, hold Aaron Judge's jockstrap at that point. So that's just
the situation. In the fans' eyes,
right. That's the situation.
That's a major factor. And
it could be.
And as far as the numbers go, I really do think that the money's going to be doing the talking. And if the Yankees are a competitive offer, they maybe don't have to offer the most, but they have to be very close to the top offer. He will probably sign with them. Now, Curry tweeted out that he does not expect the Yankees to go over 8 years. I don't know if that's going to get it done, because I do think the Phillies or the White Sox, who are more desperate for a Manny Machado type player, would be willing to go 10 years. And if the difference is 2 years and $60 million guaranteed, if he's getting that $30 million AAV, I don't think he's going to walk away from that. He's going to kind of be like A-Rod was in 2000. He's going to take the dollars.
So it's interesting, because it's really going to come down to how these contracts are structured too, because everybody looks at 10 years, 8 years, and those might be the deciding factors. Well, you know, because of all of the flexibility that have been in a lot of these long-term contracts lately, with opt-outs and backloading and front-loading and, you know, all of these different things that are ways to maneuver around, you know, whether it's a luxury tax or trying to, protect the club or protect the player for certain situations. It's going to be interesting how it's done, because even an 8-year versus a 10-year deal, if the Yankees were to, and you know, we've talked about this in the past, and I know it's come up in our Facebook group discussions with the, you know, the whole community and Facebook, about the difference between, you know, a shorter term contract for Manny Machado and a much higher dollar value versus the longer term contract and still a high value, but not as high, but you're front loading everything. Whereas you can make a 10-year contract and build it to essentially a 4 to 5 year contract with a player opt out at some point and front loading the deal. So right. It'll just be interesting to see how it's laid out, because I think the Yankees can offer the most money per year. I just don't think they're going to offer the most years for the whole contract. That's just how I see it. And to me, like, if I'm Manny Machado, I do that, because at that point I'm betting on myself with a lot of money in the front that's guaranteed. And if I do perform, then you know what? I have an opt out and I can do this all again.
Right. The opt out. So let's just take 10 years and $300 million as the framework of the deal. But if you front load the first 5 years of it for $40 million a year, and the second 5 years of it for $20 million a year with a player opt-out in the middle of it, Machado might be enticed to opt out because he'll be 31 years old. Still, that's a 31 is like kind of the average age for a major free agent, because Machado is the rarity where he came in the league at such a young age. 26, 27 years old is not your normal free agent. That's why we're talking about these kind of numbers for him. But if he opts out at 31, having banked all that money already, he could sign another 8-year deal. So he might opt out, and then the Yankees get him for the 5 years and then let him walk, or it might backfire like with the A-Rod thing and they re-sign him because Machado has the upper hand or whatever. You don't know. You can play that scenario out down the line. But I could see a contract like that maybe being something the Yankees will do.
Yeah, and I think that, I mean, you're talking about a backfire with A-Rod, but they had the option whether they were going to or not. It was an opportunity to not re-sign or to sign. So you're putting yourself in a position at least where you have another decision. And, you know, for that, like, when you're looking at a long-term contract and you're backloading it, there's two different things that I see. The one, you're paying them for the prime of their career, right? That's essentially what's going to happen. You're paying for them for their absolute prime. And Machado, those first 5 years are you're probably going to get the best baseball. But then you're giving him an opportunity to opt out to make more money. Or, God forbid, an injury were to happen, he has insurance where at that time, you know, even if you were not to opt out, then he has those backloaded dollars that are still significant dollars if you're not even at that earning potential any longer. So to me, it's a very good deal for both parties if you were to do it that way.
Another thing, as we were talking about this, so the Stanton deal takes them through 2027. There's a team option in 2028. So they may be looking at that. Well, we already agreed to the Stanton contract. We're locked in there. They might want to use that 2027, 2028 season as another milestone point where they're going to reset again. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think it's too far away to even know, right? It's too far
it's
out.
You don't know where you're going to be, but if you start to line up your major contracts to all be, because that's kind of what happened with the 2009 contracts, right? They all came up around the 2016-2017 season, and that's when they did the reset. So they
don't you want to do a better job at that instead of having a team in purgatory for 4 years?
I don't know how the Yankees don't have to look at it the same way that other teams have to look at it.
Yeah. No, I think it's too far out that they would look at that as like the reset time. I mean, obviously it really depends on how well and how things happen, I think, in the next 3 years and to see where the success of this team is. But, you know, I mean, personally, that's why I like the deal of these opt-outs and trying to work around it, because you're going to be in a position in probably 4 to 5 years where you're going to look down and you're going to say, all right, we got a lot more players that need to be signed before that even. And where are we? Because even if you're looking at where Stanton's contract ends, you have other guys that are going to be coming up well before that you have to pay and figure things out. So it's a fluid situation. It's not, to me, there's no like set date when you're like, okay, we're going to be resetting now, because you just don't know what guys are going to resign for what value and for how long. It's just too many right now. The difference being, I think, between now and 2009 is we have so many young guys on this team that are, you know, don't have their big contracts yet. Where in 2009, it was different. We had established players, mostly established contracts, and then a lot of free agents.
Yeah, 2009 was a last ditch effort to win again with the core four.
Yeah, it's a different situation. This is more of the beginning.
Yeah. And moving to the other third baseman currently on the roster, Andujar, there was an article on The Athletic posted this week that Adrian Beltre offered to help Andujar with his defense. And that was just music to our ears, because we've been half joking about that for 4 months, ever since Beltre said he was going to retire. All right, get Beltre on the payroll, have him call up Andujar. And he's not even on the payroll. He just offered to help him because Beltre was Andujar's childhood hero. But it's beautiful. I love it.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think we were half joking. I was dead serious. Like, did Beltre and
Andujar, we were joking in the sense, to hook like, up. This is our plan, which, you know.
Andujar made it very clear to Beltre that, you know, he was his guy growing up. Are they both Dominican? They're both countrymen. So that's, mm-hmm. that's, you know, a big deal. You know, who knows when the World Baseball Classic comes out, and we could see Beltre back on that team. Andujar, you know, there's a connection there. There's a hometown, home country connection there. And I'm glad it's working out. I'm glad Beltre has offered to Andujar because he sees a guy that has a ridiculous amount of potential. No longer is he, you know, a competitor. And Beltre says, okay, now I can push my wisdom of defense and footwork and throwing mechanics onto this young player who has such great potential. Here we go. I expect gold gloves next year.
Also in that article was the talking about what the Yankees specifically want him to work on. His footwork and his first step is what they highlighted. And they issued him with an iPad of video for him to work on all offseason. So it's weird because we've been talking about, are the Yankees going to trade Andujar? He's the guy who's most floated around. Like, you don't even hear Gleyber Torres' name in trade rumors. Is this whole thing around his defense about them keeping him or about them boosting his value for the trade market, or both?
I mean, yeah, it's everything. I mean, you have to assume right now you're going to have Adrian Beltre. You're going to have Miguel Andujar as your third baseman. I mean, that is what the situation is right now. So it's not like you can plan to not have the player. You got to plan to have the player. And even if they were planning on trading him, I still think they would do the same thing because they have an appreciation and a respect for the player to make him better while he's currently on their team. And that's exactly what's happening. And, you know, he could very well be a very long-term piece on this team. So they're going to go about it the way that they normally would and say, look, we need to improve your defense. This is what you need to improve. Here's how you can improve it while you're at home. And then who knows how Beltre got, you know, the little whisper in his ear to go reach out to Andujar. It could have been Andujar reaching out to him. It could have been someone in the Yankees organization saying, hey, reach out to Andujar, please. Could have been A-Rod. Who knows? Could have been anybody. Podcast. Could have been a lot of things. Yeah. I mean, Beltre's a loyal listener. That's obvious. So, you know, I think that they go about it and they try to improve Andujar's defense because it's not like it's a secret. Everybody knows that's his biggest flaw.
That article also talked about, and I've heard this a lot on from people on Twitter and also on sports radio, that Andujar was benched in the game 4 of the ALDS, the most important game of the season, because it was win or go home. And Andujar was benched because of his defense. And while I think his defense factored in, I also think it was because they were looking for a shakeup in the lineup. And Andujar had one hit in that Boston series. He looked lost at the plate. He was swinging at everything. He did not look comfortable. Neil Walker, on the other hand, was having better at-bats and can play better defense. So I think it was a combination of not just defense, but also he was not hitting. If he was hitting 500 in the series, you think they would have sat him because of his defense in game 4? Hell no.
No, they definitely wouldn't have. It was the fact that he was struggling with the bat was the reason they did it. I mean, yes. The defense absolutely is a contributing factor, and you're getting a better defender if he's not in the game, pretty much with anybody playing third at that point. But the fact that he wasn't hitting was the reason, because otherwise what they most likely would have done is what we had seen in the past, is you start him, you get him, you know, X amount of at-bats, and then you sub him in for a defensive replacement if you need to. But you need that bat in the lineup. So I 1,000% think it was because of the bat, and then, you know, the easy way to play that it was because of his defense.
Yep. All right, we mentioned earlier Sabathia had that heart procedure. He had an angioplasty. He was feeling symptoms of acid reflux and heartburn. I've been there. But apparently they were much worse. He was exercising and sweating profusely. So he went to the doctor, went to the team doctors, and then they realized that he had a blockage in one of his arteries, and he had the angioplasty. That happened a couple weeks ago, but the news came out on Friday. It was Friday.
Yeah. So it's concerning, obviously, because, you know, he's getting up there in age. He's a bigger dude. Anytime you're talking about the heart, there's concern. The angioplasty is more of a routine procedure. Not that anything with the heart is routine, but that is one of the more routine procedures, I think. So it seems like it did exactly what they needed to do, and you know, hopefully he's it's going to work out well for him, obviously. But they're still planning on him doing, you know, normal offseason stuff and reporting to camp, and so it seems like they caught everything when they needed to catch it. CC was very open and honest with the way he's feeling, which I hope everybody in the world is, when it's especially about your heart. And he told the right people what he was feeling, and they went in and accordingly took care of it. So I'm glad to see that the big man is on the mend and got it caught, taken care of early.
It's just, it's crazy because you sign a 38-year-old pitcher who's got a lot of miles on him. You don't expect to see heart procedure as the headline, you know? So glad he's doing healthy.
It's one of those things that, you know, no matter who you are, whether you're, you know, working, you know, in finance or at a gas station, or you're a Major League Baseball player, if there's something going on with an artery, you know, or you have a clog in your heart, like, it doesn't matter what you do. It doesn't matter how many innings you have on your arm. Like, those are things that just pop up. And I think as you get older, they can pop up with more frequency, and they're a higher percentage of coming up. So just glad he got it taken care of.
He did say on his podcast that the Kansas City was his favorite stop because of the barbecue.
Yeah. I mean, we've seen the way the man eats. Like, it's also a part of, like, how you treat your body and how you, and just your makeup too. So there's a lot of different things. None of us probably know, you know, the details of why CC is having these types of issues. But again, just glad that it was caught and taken care of.
All right, let's run through some league news quickly. There's a bunch of things that have happened. So Brantley signed with the Astros for 2 years and $32 million. It's significantly less guaranteed dollars than McCutchen got, but it's about the same AAV, $16 million, just one less year. Andrew Miller, who maybe the Yankees were going to be in on, signed in St. Louis. The Yankees were not in on Andrew Miller. Daniel Murphy, who I know was floated around as a potential fit for the Yankees because he's a left-handed bat, is going to the Rockies. I don't really get Murphy not signing with an American League team because I do think he's more of a DH first baseman at this point. Anything in here of this news you want to highlight?
Yeah, I mean, Anibal Sanchez, they're talking about, like, he's kind of become, I saw an article about him being like a right-handed CC Sabathia-like type player now, how he's kind of reimagined himself and now is, you know, just very difficult against right-handed bats and just kind of has proven to be a new type of pitcher. I haven't really seen him pitch in years. You know, he's always been kind of a mediocre guy. Daniel Murphy, I agree to an extent. Like, it seems like it would be a more natural fit for a AL team, but I think he's probably going to play first base, and I think that's okay when you're playing if you're the Rockies. If you're going to play first base, then I think Daniel Murphy could be just fine. Plus, it's a 2-year deal, so I think the defense won't be as much of an issue. I think when you're talking about him at second base and, like, the Yankees rumors or people floating him in there of him potentially playing second base or even sliding around to the infield, maybe at first base because of the left-handed bat, it's like, I don't know. You're adding another liability to the middle of the infield at certain days. Just not really what I want. Like, I like his bat, but there's just you'd be adding another player with an issue.
In the first half, when you have your best infield defender, Didi, out, and then you'd be talking about the second, third, and short could potentially be a broken down Daniel Murphy, an inconsistent Glaber at short, and then Andujar with his defensive struggles at third. That would be ugly.
Yeah, it's when you add another guy like that has issues that you know of defensively, then you know you're signing him purely for his bat, and I think the Yankees are doing okay with the bat at this point. I think a lot of the offensive woes, the fact that we need a left-handed bat is very much overblown. I don't think they desperately need it. But yeah, so Daniel Murphy wasn't really a great fit for me. And then Andrew Miller, you know, the guy signed, I think a lot of people thought he was going to possibly get a 1-year deal because of the injury issues. Obviously St. Louis was comfortable enough to go in there and offer 2 years, and they offered a third year vesting option that could make this a 3-year, $36 million deal, which is a good deal for Miller if he's able to get there and he's healthy. And I think it's also a good deal if he is healthy and the Cardinals are getting a high end Andrew Miller. So otherwise he would most likely be costing more money than this. So I think it's a good deal both ways, especially if he's healthy for the Cardinals.
Yeah, and when you look at what some of these relievers have gotten, like Miller and then Joe Kelly with the Dodgers got 3 years, Jerry's Familia got 3 years with the Mets, that kind of sets the tone for what the Yankees might need to offer for someone like Robertson or Ottavino, or if they want to re-sign Zach Britton.
Yeah, I think that's probably the benchmark, is that 3-year deal. And whether it's through a vesting option at the end, like Miller did, and I think that's because of his injury history. You're looking at a guy like Ottavino or even D-Rob, you're not going to put that vesting option most likely. If I were them, I wouldn't accept that vesting option because why?
Robertson
because of the age, but it's...
Yeah, I'm looking up his age right now. I forget how old he is. He's 33. Yeah. He's going to be 34 next season. And Andrew Miller.
So I could see him 34. So I could see D-Rob going with the vesting age, option only because of his age. And maybe that's part of it. But he's been very durable for his entire career.
Would you do that for Robertson? Would you do the exact same Andrew Miller contract?
No. No, I would not. I would not. At this point in their... Like I think David Robertson is an effective player. I would probably do 2 years for David Robertson. I don't think I'd go for that third year. But I don't know. You're talking about a vesting option.
So you've sort of like the HAP, like we talked about last week. If it vests, that means he had a good year.
Yeah, but at the same time, when you're looking at relievers, when you're getting at that age, you could vest depending on what the option is for it to vest.
It's most likely appearances or innings pitched.
Innings pitched, something like that. Yeah. Relief pitchers could fall off a cliff very fast. So I think it's a different animal. It's a different animal when we're talking about David Robertson in that age. I think with Jay Happ, when you're seeing like a durability throughout the entire year, I don't know, they're conditioned differently. And for whatever reason, I've seen Jay Happ pitch at an older age. D-Rob, he's at that weird age now where it could go south fast.
Yeah, he's been durable through 33, but who knows if he's going to be durable 34, 35, 36.
Yeah, and with Happ, we've seen him pitch older and effectively. So it's like his body is going well. There is a wall for everybody. Who knows, man? It's just a feeling with David Robertson. I wouldn't want to do that third year. And for whatever reason, like I think that if whoever signs Zach Britton for next year, I think they're going to get a very good deal because I don't think he pitched to his maximum potential this year. Coming off that Achilles injury, it was a year ago, really, this time when he had surgery in 2017 for the Achilles. Like I was surprised how fast he came back and how well he did pitch when he did come back. I mean, we saw how sporadic he was, I think, with the Orioles. But then as he came over, we saw some signs towards the end of the year of Britton, coming back to the old guy. And I got to believe when you're a full year and a half out from that injury and from that surgery and your body's built up that much more. I have a feeling that whoever signs him is going to get much closer to the real Zach Britton than what we saw.
Well, he's going to, I think, get 3 years guaranteed.
Yeah, I could see that definitely, especially because the injury is, a year out
in the rearview mirror.
He's proved that he could pitch.
The one thing I think you and I were both, a lot of people were disappointed with Britton was the command. He would lose his command at times and he would walk people, which is very uncharacteristic for him. Now, is that a factor of coming back from the injury or is that fluky? Well, what was that? I don't really know. Hopefully, like you said, full year of recovery, full off season of being healthy, that changes.
Yeah, and I think that's exactly what it is. I think it could be, whether it still hurts or it's just mechanical or it's fatigue. I could absolutely see the Achilles and that whole area getting fatigued after you go through, a surgery like that and coming back and then playing for as long as he did. I mean, he was still durable with what he went through. Like, again, it's surprising to me how fast he could come back from that Achilles.
He was still effective. He was still an effective relief pitcher.
Absolutely. But you're right.
But he wasn't the
command.
It wasn't 2015 Zach Britton who was like one of the best relief seasons of all time.
I'm not sure we ever see that again, but I think he can get very close back to more
80%
of his peak.
Of it is still. Yeah. Fantastic.
Well, I think even 80%, I think he could exceed that. I think once he's fully healthy and he has the confidence of the bottom half, the lower half, then I think you start seeing that command get back to exactly where it was. And you don't see a lot of those issues because when you have fatigue, we talked about this with Severino, fatigue will absolutely turn into control issues and mechanical issues. And all of those things are connected. So I definitely think that whoever gets him is going to be pleasantly surprised.
And who knows where Robertson's market shakes out because the Red Sox might be in on Robertson. Veritek's wife tweeted that the Yankee-Red Sox rivalry is going to be even better next year, even more interesting next year. What the hell is she talking about? I can't imagine that David Robertson as the swing piece in that rivalry, really. I don't want Robertson to go to the Red Sox because I like David Robertson and I think he can still be a good reliever and that would make the Red Sox better, but if he goes there, I'm not going to like lose sleep over, how could he betray the Yankees like that?
Right. Yeah, no, I don't know how that really intensifies the rivalry. Maybe she just had a little too much eggnog and was just talking in generality and how it's going to be better. It was right after Machado had visited too, and maybe she's just assuming Machado was going to the Yankees.
Okay, that could be. That's actually a good theory because Machado had the Red Sox stuff with Pedroia, spiking Pedroia. Remember that from a couple years ago?
Absolutely. He has been very vocal in the fact that he doesn't like the Red Sox. And I'm surprised that hasn't been more of a talked about thing with Machado and the fact that he does not like the Red Sox and how well that will play for Yankee fans too. When you bring over a guy that not only is a world class, the gold standard, but he's also a Red Sox hater. Like, how do you not love that?
That's a good selling point on Machado. We've talked about a long time how we love that rivalry when it's heated up. We got the brawl last year. They met in the playoffs again. The whole Judge New York bullshit. So sure, add some more lighter fluid to that fire.
If there's a fiery Machado and there's that edge of him that people don't like, how about we use that edge for our advantage and bring him on there as a catalyst to go out there and to beat the Boston Red Sox? I mean, I'm liking this more and more as I talk about it, to tell you the truth.
And then as far as like weird trades go, so this Dodgers-Reds one ranks up there for me as weird because the Dodgers are offloading money. They're sending Matt Kemp, Yasiel Puig, and Alex Wood to the Reds in exchange for Homer Bailey. And right now we know one of the top infield prospects for the Reds, Jeter Downs, is going to the Dodgers. I get it from a Dodgers standpoint. They're clearing off money. They're potentially going to make a big offer to Bryce Harper. I don't understand what the Reds are doing. They're kind of in purgatory of mediocrity, so whatever.
Yeah, it's weird with the like. I do understand what the Dodgers are doing. I don't understand what the Cincinnati Reds are doing. I think they are blinded by the fact that they think they can win next year. I really think they think they can win next year, and it's pretty shocking to me.
Really, because they're in a division with the Brewers, who just went to their championship series, the Cubs, who are still going to be one of the better teams in baseball, and also the Cardinals, who are always good.
It makes no sense to me. That's what I'm saying. Like, I don't understand why they think they can actually do that. So Jeter Downs is one of their middle infield prospects. He was rumored at some point about the irony of a Sonny Gray trade and a guy named Jeter coming back to the Yankees. So that's why I think a bunch of people know his name. And then
he's got to be named after Derek Jeter, correct?
I mean, I don't know why your name would be Jeter otherwise. First names. The Josiah Gray is the other deal that we know that went there. And he's a low A rookie ball pitcher that's had some success. So the Dodgers actually got some decent players back, which is again more to the head scratchingness of this deal with them just unloading their contracts and getting rid of, like, Yasiel Puig was at the end of towards the end of the year was really just a platoon guy. He wasn't starting against, you know, he was splitting time in right field. And Matt Kemp is old as dirt, and I know he had a good year, but he was paid a ton of money, so it's a very weird deal. But it seems like they're making a run at Bryce Harper, and Cincinnati was just like, okay, here, yeah, we'll take all those contracts. Go ahead. And, oh, here's some potential talent for you.
Mm-hmm. Jeter Downs, born in July of 1998, most definitely named after Derek Jeter.
Yeah. Where's he from? Do we know?
He was born in Columbia, but he went to high school in Miami.
Okay. No Jeter connection so far there.
Well, you never know. He plays shortstop. All right, you ready to get into some mailbags?
Yeah.
The first one is from Adam. Why does it seem like we aren't in on Keuchel? He's a proven starter with a 60% ground ball rate. Would he not be a good fit in New York?
I think at this point, I mean, we hadn't really heard much about Keuchel in New York talking even. If your ears to the rumor mill, there really wasn't much about Keuchel in New York. But as far as fit, like, yeah, I see the fit. The ground ball rate is very good. Obviously, you want ground ball pitchers at Yankee Stadium. That's a good thing. But the fact that they signed Happ and they're getting, what they want, basically 2 to 3 year deal with Happ, then they're not going to overextend. At this point, I certainly don't think they would even be remotely in on Keuchel because of the fact that they signed Happ. But it doesn't sound like they were really targeting him. They wanted Happ over Keuchel in the first place is what it seems like.
It's going to be actually really interesting where Keuchel's market shakes out, because MLB trade rumors originally in the offseason projected 4 years and $82 million, which is $20.5 million per year for Keuchel. Now, looking at what Corbin got, he got the 6 years, but Corbin's also a couple years younger. And then what Happ got, who's a couple years older, Keuchel kind of falls in the middle. Like, what teams are going to be willing to to signing Keuchel for 4 years. I mean, the Astros seem like they would want to bring him back, but there hasn't really been a ton of talks about that. So you're only looking at teams that are going to win in the next 4 years. And really, those teams, there's only a handful of those teams.
But when you're looking, I think Philadelphia seems like a really good match. I mean, Philadelphia's on
the rise. Well, they're just like, they're blowing all their money this offseason.
Yeah, they're spending a lot of money, but they're also a team on the rise that, you know, I don't know. He just feels like he could be a fit in Philadelphia with that ugly ass beard. I could see him fitting in there with the Phillies. That beard wouldn't play in New York, obviously. And I don't know. Just he feels like a guy that would do well in Philadelphia. It's going to be interesting to contract because when you're talking about that, but you know, you didn't mention the Eovaldi deal too. That's like smack in the middle of everything.
I totally forgot. I try and block that out of my mind.
When you're looking at what Eovaldi got at $17 million a year, like that's probably where you are. And then Keuchel's like, come on, like you better give me more than freaking Nathan Eovaldi got at this point.
And
so, you know, whether it's $5 more or $1 million more, like optics to me, if I'm Dallas Keuchel, like I got to get more than Nathan Eovaldi. Like I was literally have been one of the most dominant pitchers in baseball, you know, over the past 3 years,
but I can't figure out where this market is shaking out. Because then I look at Charlie Morton, who I would have thought would have gotten more than Eovaldi, because Eovaldi had one good month and got him 4 years. I just don't understand it. Whereas Morton has been a good pitcher for a couple of years now, and he got 2 years from the Rays.
Yeah, it's a strange market. It really is. And it also, I think it depends on what the player is looking at. Are they looking at, you know, maximum value per year, and they're trying to, you know, get that rather than the long-term deal? You know, I think there, it seems like, you know, whether the market was showing him anything longer, but Morton definitely took the shorter deal with the higher average value. Whereas Eovaldi saw the 4 years at, you know, maybe
Eovaldi got $17 million a year. Morton only got $15 a year.
Yeah, I think that Eovaldi was coming off such a high. Morton was down a little bit to where he was in the past. Also, Morton's been around the block a little bit. Like he's had success, and he's an older guy. So yeah, the fact that he got that,
had two Tommy John surgeries,
but he's still young. He's younger than everybody on free agency.
The Red Sox were bidding against themselves for Eovaldi.
Yes, I think so, and I think they had to bring a guy back like that. The fact that he had such success there, and the fact that he is as young as he is, they're banking on that his arm is fixed. You know, they know something. Again, the bionic arm, whatever's going on in there, the non-natural fibers that are now in his elbow, the Red Sox know about it, okay? That's just what's happening. And they're paying him so that they can keep him for 4 years of the bionic elbow. I don't know what else to tell you.
All right. Well, Keuchel, yeah, I just don't see it happening with what the Yankees have already done this offseason. I don't think Happ and Keuchel were a realistic possibility. They ended up choosing Happ. They got Happ back. We both like that deal. I don't think Keuchel, they even speak with him. All right, moving on. Lee Jones from Liverpool.
And I hate Dallas Keuchel, for the record. Yeah, I hate Dallas Keuchel, so I'm happy that they didn't even talk to him.
And he, I think he would look weird without a beard. You say he looks ugly with the beard, but I think he would look weird without the beard.
He would look weird without the beard. He looks ugly with the beard. He would look even uglier without the beard, probably. I don't like anything about him. I don't like his face. I don't like his beard. I don't like him. He would probably be a horrible pitcher with the Yankees. Then we'd hate him even more, and we'd have him for 4 years. It's not a good fit. I don't like him. Yeah, he throws the ground balls. Great. I hate every other part about him.
Okay. Lee says, there was a lot of talk about the Yankees signing Corbin and Happ, potentially experimenting with a six-man rotation, or at the very least, ensuring they had depth. With Happ signed and Corbin off the table, do you still think we're looking for a sixth starting pitcher, most likely in a trade? And we've said this a million times, but they wanted Corbin and Happ. They got Paxton and Happ. I don't see much of a difference there.
No, there's not much of a difference. There's a very, very, very similar player set as far as what you're getting now and really for the next 2 years, 3 years. Like, this is what we've got. It's you hope what you get with Corbin is what you're hoping you get with Paxton. Like, they both have the potential, and they both have, I think, the high ceiling but it's not very different. Like, I think they both have a similar high ceiling. Maybe Paxton has a higher ceiling even. So who knows? But yeah, I think it's very similar. Will they go out and get someone else? Again, it would not surprise me if Cashman were to go out and make another deal for a guy that's, you know, not a big name, but someone that could come in and you know, be a swing guy at the same time, or it could be a six starter. But again, man, like, again, not a popular opinion and not one that I even like saying, but they still kind of do have that guy in their payroll, and that will probably cost about $9 million in arbitration. And that's Sonny Gray. And I know everybody hates him. And I know I talked about this last week. I'm not even going to harp on this any longer. But the fact that they have a five-man rotation set at this point, unless you're going to get something of value that really that makes a lot of sense for what you need now as a team or what you could be building, and it's not just some throw-in, then to me there's more value for a guy like Sonny Gray as starting out as like a middle long relief guy, a swingman type thing, and see if he can build his value back up.
Yeah, and I think they're confident in the five starters they have, at least for the first part of the season, to be very, very strong. And then Cashman likes to have the flexibility of seeing what the team looks like, what do they need to do in June and July, how can they add someone then?
Yes, I agree. And I think that's also a big consideration of how they position themselves, you know, at this point with prospects and making trades. Like, we're all talking about trading for another piece right now, but probably the you know, more value for the Yankees and Brian Cashman is to potentially hold on to these pieces. And like you're saying, make that trade in, you know, June, July, when you know more of what your team looks like and what you need to get you over that edge. Like, that's where, and I know there's more of a premium paid at the trade deadline than in the off season. But if you don't have those prospects, then you can't even try to make that premium, you know, during the trade deadline.
And there's a guy out there, Madison Bumgarner, who's going into the last year of his deal, and he's going to be on a really terrible San Francisco Giants team. They have delusions of grandeur. They think they're going to compete once again next year. They're not. They're going to be bad. Who's to say they don't want to trade him and just get something for him of value because he's got 2 months left anyway on his contract?
I mean, they absolutely should. That's exactly what they should do. If they were to wait, not sell him in the offseason, but do it at the trade deadline, like, they're going to get max value. So if I'm San Francisco, I'm doing the exact same thing. I'm going to hopefully have a good year and then we could use him. But if we don't, you know, the fan base is going to be like, can we please lose like 10 games in a row before the deadline so that we can have some clarity here and trade him and build our team back up? Because, you know, that's the move. It's similar to what the Orioles were, you know, in a situation with Machado and even Britton. Like, that's what's going to happen. It's a very, very dumb baseball move if they don't.
But you can get teams tend to be more desperate for pitching, starting pitching at the trade deadline than they do position players.
No doubt. And we know what kind of an impact it makes. I mean, we saw exactly the direct impact the trade from Detroit to Houston that Justin Verlander made on the Houston Astros. They won the World freaking Series, and he was a huge difference maker down the stretch. So a guy like Bumgarner, who's got, like, what do we really want him for? Do we want him for the regular season, or do we want him for the postseason?
Want him for game one of whatever playoff series they start.
So think about how that is going to play out. Like, that's going to be part of the trade narrative too at the deadline. Like, you're getting a guy that has, you know, ridiculous postseason numbers. He's a horse.
He's a postseason legend. He is.
So you know what he is, and that's what you're getting him for.
Yes, he is. He's will go down in history as one of the best postseason runs of all time. What he did to the Kansas City Royals in 2014. He murdered them. He murdered the city of Kansas City.
And granted, it's a different guy because you're older. While he's not as old as people think he is, he's definitely got a lot of tread on the tire, not a lot of tread on the tire left. I don't even know what the hell I'm trying to say. He's got a lot of miles on the arm.
He's not the same pitcher he was 5 years ago.
No, he's not.
He's still a very, very good pitcher. And we talked about also him a few weeks ago with the hard hit percentage going up and the velocity going down. But having said all that, you still have to put it in context. And look, he was still a good pitcher. He's not a top five pitcher in baseball anymore, but he's still a very, very good starting pitcher.
But you're also seeing him in San Francisco. That's a little bit more forgiving for a pitcher. Whereas if you were to come to one of these small American League ballparks, you know, that could be a thing. So you have to look at what he is currently and also not get caught up in what happened in the World Series against the Kansas City Royals. Because if you're going to do that, if any baseball team is going to do that, they're not going to get the same guy. and it's delusions of grandeur at that point. Like, I don't even think when if you get a Madison Bumgarner coming into 2018 playoffs, he's not going to most likely be the number one starter in a postseason series. You're going to hope you get that same tenacity from a guy that's pitching your number two or even number three game.
You're talking about if hypothetical 2019 playoffs, you mean?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it all depends. It really depends on how the rotation shakes out, if they have the division one or if they're in another wild card game. Like, there's so many factors.
Yeah, there's a lot. And with the Red Sox being right there, there's a high possibility that this wild card for either the Yankees or the Red Sox, you know, will certainly be a major factor down the stretch.
Yeah, I think it's most likely going to be the same situation as last year where the Yankees and the Red Sox are around 100 wins and one of them's going to have to play that friggin' wild card game.
Yep. Yep.
All right, final question is from Jason A525 on Twitter. With CeCe only signed for 1 year, the Yankees need to be all in on Gerrit Cole again next year. If he's available, Sale, because why not? Do you think that's part of the reason why the Yankees were hesitant on Corbin? And I've seen this not only with what Jason just said about pitching, but the Yankees fans saying, oh, maybe the Yankees are waiting. They're not going to sign Machado because they really want Nolan Arenado. Like, this notion of waiting another year in free agency.
I don't think it's a factor that they're waiting. It's you can look at what is there. And as a fallback too, and not to say that like that's a very first world problem as far as a fallback, an Arenado to Machado. But when you're looking at the, you're not going to overextend yourself for this player. You have pieces that you think can win right now, so you don't need to make that move. And then yeah, you can assess the situation again next year, and you're also and there's a phenomenal player also available at that position. And we're looking at the pitching, like there's some good pitching available next year too. So if you don't get the guy you want, but you can get a guy for a shorter term deal that you think will be effective and really you won't lose as much, then, you know, you can reassess again what happens next year. I don't think it's necessarily them waiting though, because to me, nothing they're doing is waiting right now.
Right. It's being smart. They're being smart. They're not being dumb with their money. And like, Yankees fans have a tough time comprehending that. They think the Yankees are being cheap when I see it as being smart with your contracts.
And fiscally responsible.
They were not smart with their contracts in the past and it bit them in the ass. Why do you want them to do it again? Why do you want them to make the same mistake again?
The problem is we could all say that right now, though, about the Stanton contract, because the Stanton contract is exactly that. You know, it's going to bite us in the ass
Two wrongs make a right?
No, that's exactly why. And I've been preaching to this the entire time. Like, the fact that that contract exists, the fact that the Yankees went and made that trade last year to get Giancarlo Stanton and taking on that $10 million contract just led me down the path that they're not going to be...
I wish it was a $10 million contract.
No, 10-year contract. And the fact that they're not going to go down this road of signing another 10-year deal. It just, or they'll be less apt to do it unless everything is right in the way that the contract lines up. They made a decision last year, knowing what was coming up in 2019, to go after Giancarlo Stanton and say that this is the guy that we want at this length. And so they made that deal and they took on a bad contract. The value of that contract, when you're looking at it comparatively, is pretty good, actually.
Theoretically, on what Machado and of it.
Yeah, and you know, we'll see how it shakes out. But what's rumored on what Machado could get or what Bryce Harper could get, if we look at those, you know, come spring training and we line up those three contracts and see which one looks worse, you know, we can make an argument that Stanton was gotten at a value. Even though the term of the value is long term,
you could also make the argument that he is the lesser of the players in those three guys, though.
You could also make the argument that he's not. I mean, he won the NL MVP last year, and Bryce Harper didn't. So, you know, there's a number of things you could
say.
Well,
Harper's won an MVP in the past, so like, well, Machado's just never won an MVP, and you know, I think Machado's the best player out of any.
It depends on what you're looking at. You could absolutely make an argument for that.
So MVP awards, I don't think, tell you the whole story.
I know. I'm more joking about that. It's just, you know, biased, conveniently biased for that one. But right. The fact that you could make an argument, I think, when you're looking at body of work for Stanton as, you know, the best player of those three, I think there absolutely could be, that argument could be made.
Okay. I would have a hard time with that argument, but fine. All right, let's wrap this up. And again, Merry Christmas to everybody out there. Thank you guys for submitting the mailbag questions. You can do that at bronxpinstripes.com/podcast. You can tweet us at Yankees Podcast, or you can submit in the Facebook group, the Bronx Pinstripe Show. We have a ton of good chatter going on in there. The again, part of this episode will be the Joe Torre curveballs along the way. Hope you enjoy that. Scott, any final words?
Yeah, just a Merry Christmas to everybody. Hope you have a very happy and safe Merry Christmas. And then we got New Year's. Is it before? No, New Year's Eve is
It'll be released on
show.
New Year's Eve. Yep.
Yeah, so that'll be interesting. I have a buddy of mine from college is actually getting married on that day. So we have a wedding slash New Year's Eve party. It's actually going
to I've heard people.
It's going to be a lot of fun.
And everyone who goes to those weddings say they're awesome because you're just at a giant party with all your friends on New Year's Eve.
Yeah. That's exactly what we're looking at. So it's going to be pretty good, I think. So we'll see how I recover from that one.
All right. Good stuff. We'll talk to you guys next Monday.
I'm sitting in the crib dreaming about Learjets and coops, the way salt shoots and how to sell records like Snoop. I'm interrupted by a doorbell. 352.
All right. Welcome back, folks. Here, this is Brian with Take 2 Podcast, and I am joined by an amazing podcast, the Bronx Pinstripe Show. I've got Scott and Andrew here with me, and we are going to review a not well-known Yankee movie, but one that hits close to home for all Yankee fans, Curveballs Along the Way, the Joe Torre story. Gentlemen, Andrew, Scott, how are you?
Good. I can't for the life of me figure out why it's not well-known.
I had never – this was – Brian, this was one of the ones when we were trying to brainstorm to find a movie. We had – you know, we all came up with the normal ones, the Babe Ruth. That was one of the ones that we had come down to, the story of – and then I searched Amazon and found Joe Torre, Curveballs Along the Way. And I'd never heard of this movie, and I know damn well why nobody has heard of this movie.
I remember seeing it when it came out on Showtime, and I was super excited to watch it. Now, Scott, you and I are similar in age, but Andrew, was this tough for you to find? I mean, you were born just like a year or two before this, right?
No, I was actually born a year after. No, I'm just kidding.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I was 8 in 96, so I was 9 when the movie came out, so this wasn't on my radar, I don't think.
So you never had the smoky flashback scenes? That's not something you grew up with?
No, it wasn't, but... I know the 90s, like a couple years ago when the Yankees did the whole 96 reunion tour and everything like that, I knew the 96 team from watching highlights and watching videos. Because you're 8 years old, like I remember it, but I don't really remember it. I watched that 1996 World Series video 500,000 times. So yeah. I know the Joe Torre story because they did a whole 10-minute segment in that World Series video about his brother getting the heart transplant. So I know it because of that World Series video.
Yeah.
Makes sense. So this one is huge. I know, Scott, I think I was born in 81. I think we're around the same age. And so this World Series obviously was gigantic, obviously just for Yankee fandom everywhere. But then for us, we were teenagers. This is right in our wheelhouse. Yep. So when this movie came out, it was like, I was like, I need to sit in front of the TV, sit and see it. And it was huge. Let's see. Directed by Sterla Gunnarsson. Don't know that name. You shouldn't know that name. They were Oscar nominated one time back in 1983 for another documentary. But outside of that, in this Joe Torre story, you didn't get much. If you watch the Joe Torre story, this Curveballs Along the Way, you'll probably understand why. I'll just come right off the bat, guys. This movie wasn't great.
No, it sucked.
It was awful.
It sucked ass.
It was so bad. It was one of the slowest. Like, there were so many things wrong with this, from casting to producing to directing. Everything to even the format, randomly Joe Torre talking to the camera.
Yeah, and break the fourth wall halfway through the movie?
It's all very random. It was like a random throw together.
You know what? So the first half of the movie, it was bad, and then it got bad good when Paul O'Neill punched the cooler.
Yeah,
I laughed out loud because that looked like a high school production, like one take. Let's see O'Neill. Can't catch the fly ball. He comes off. He punches the cooler. It was terrible. That point in the movie, I was like, okay, this is so bad, it's good.
So my most hated filmmaking technique is breaking the fourth wall. So you hit a huge nail on the head, and it was completely unnecessary for the film. Like, they were telling the story without narration, without anything along the way, fine. There was no reason for Paul Sorvino to then look into camera and just give, like, not even a advancement in the plot line tidbit that he wanted to let you know about. That was... interesting why they would go that route. Paul Sorvino, of course, is playing Joe Torre. Only other notable cast is Robert Loggia. Now, in our pre-show notes, You noted that Robert Loggia was from Independence Day fame.
Yep. My favorite movie of all time.
Okay. All right. If it's your favorite of all time, we'll give it to you then. I'm sorry. When I think him, I think the scene in Big of dancing on the piano.
Sure.
With Tom
Hanks. Like, I understand he's had bigger roles, but he was the general in Independence Day. That's the first thing I thought of when I saw his face.
So where are you on Independence Day Resurgence? He was in there too.
Independence Day Resurgence, not good. probably on par with Joe Torre curveballs along the way. But Independence Day 1, peak Will Smith, Jeff Goldblum. Like, I could talk about that movie all day.
I mean, I'm a fan of the first Independence Day. I haven't even seen the second one. But, Bill Pullman got me in Spaceballs. So ever since then, I'm a fan.
Yes.
Now, other interesting casting, Gaylord Sartain played Don Zimmer. He's more famous for being in all the Ernest movies. Your Ernest goes to camp, saves Christmas, goes to jail. I feel that's a miscast that we should have had Don Zimmer actually in all those films.
Yeah, Don Zimmer should have played himself, you're saying? Or he should have
he should have been in the Ernest
played
movies.
All of the Sartain roles. I got you. Yeah. See, he was too fat to play Zimmer. Like, Zimmer was heavy, but not that fat.
He had too much hair, I thought.
He had way too much hair. That was the biggest problem. I mean, like, the weight didn't really bother me, but how about a little bit of dedication to the role and shave your head if you're coming in the mirror with hair. I mean, it was clearly not Don Zimmer.
This Showtime movie is not really something you're going to get actors to really do something out of their way for.
Well, you know what? Then let's rethink the casting then and get a fat, bald guy that could go out there and play Don Zimmer.
I think it should have just been Don Zimmer. You could have just told him he'd show up here at 5 o'clock. He wouldn't have known what's going on.
No, that would have been good. I think Don Zimmer playing himself would have been a much better line in the credits. There's no doubt.
Go ahead.
No, I was going to say more about casting the Dean McDermott as David Cohn. Is it just me or does he look exactly like Tom Glavin?
I mean, I see that. I think that was probably one of the better castings.
It was because Glavin and Cohn, you could say, could be related at least. But I thought Dean McDermott looks like to a T like Tom Glavin. Anyway, this is weird. Probably only I think. Maybe a couple other people out there will realize it.
Dean McDermott more famous for being married to Tori Spelling.
Ooh, I didn't know that. The problem I have with casting in a lot of sports movies in general, but specifically in this one too, you're talking about the guy from that, what is that, that depressing show that I'm constantly seeing the commercials for that everybody loves on NBC, I think.
This Is Us?
Yeah, thank you. The guy from that who played Doc Gooden, who couldn't throw a baseball that looking anywhere remotely close to athletic. It really pisses me off when I'm watching a sports movie with guys who are the most unathletic looking people in scene as well. The guy who played Wade Boggs, holy good God, seeing him swing a bat, his hands never went above his hips. Like, I've never seen anybody swung a bat like that.
It's like no one knew, practiced a baseball swing or baseball throwing motion. You get that in golf too when you see golf movies. That wasn't even the worst casting though. I'm curious what you guys think is the worst casting because I think that the Wade Boggs one was maybe third worst. What did you guys think was the worst casting?
I guess I would probably stick with Zimmer just for the hair and his overweight. If I can just quickly, Isaiah Washington's not in This Is Us, the Sterling K. Brown.
Oh, okay.
He was in Grey's Anatomy.
Facts. Oh, yeah.
We don't do facts on our podcast.
Yeah. He was in Grey's Anatomy.
Yeah, he was on Grey's for a long time, so you might be thinking of that.
Maybe. I just know I've seen him in a bunch of commercials that for shows that I haven't watched. But the fact is that he couldn't throw a ball and look like halfway athletic. And that to me is just a deal breaker when we're talking about a sports movie because it's not believable at that point. Or they have to do like, you know, some very sneaky cutting away at key moments so that they don't look as unathletic as possible. But as far as like the worst, I don't know. I really kind of lumped them all into terrible, all of them. Probably Tori was the best of all of them with Sorvino, but that was the rest of them were just pretty bad.
So Diego Fuentes playing Mariano Duncan, that was the absolute worst casting in the entire movie.
It was bad casting, bad, horrible acting. I
mean, they butchered the "we win, we played today, we win today, that's it" line. And they did it like four different times in the movie. I cringed every single time.
Yeah, it's the one thing he's famous for. It's like the one thing they needed to get right for him.
And the Daryl Strawberry casting was pretty terrible, too.
I was like, did David Justice play on this team?
Yeah,
pretty sure that David Justice.
He would have been perfect for David Justice. He looked like the guy who played David Justice in Moneyball.
As soon as he walked in the door, I'm like, wait, this is the wrong year. David Justice wasn't here, and he was. It took me a minute to find out to realize that he was playing Strawberry. It was very confusing.
See, this is at the point in the movie where it's getting bad good.
I mean, you're looking at a 5.5 Metascore on IMDb. It didn't even grab a Rotten Tomatoes rating. They didn't even go back because there was no real critical reviews for it. I think the ratings for this was nothing but 96 Yankee fans that wanted to watch it. Otherwise, know who you want. The story itself, of course, is all about, they try and make it about Joe Torre's life. They go through, you know, his upbringing as a kid. His brother, Frank, was a ball player, and he gets to go see him play in the World Series and what have you. And then he gets older, and then now he gets these jobs as a manager. Someone throws the stat at him that he has played in and managed the most games in uniform without touching the World Series. Was that it?
Yes.
Yeah. Most games in baseball that has not been to a World Series, which I had
That's
forgotten
true,
that number.
No,
that was a big deal.
That was talked about when he was hired. Remember the whole Clueless Joe thing like that?
Yeah.
I feel like the movie didn't go into that enough, because that was when Joe Torre was hired. Everyone was killing Steinbrenner because Showalter took them to the playoffs the previous year. They had the best record in baseball or in the American League in 94 before the strike. Showalter gets canned, and then fans are irate because they hire a guy who was fired by the Mets, Braves, and Cardinals and had played more games in baseball history and never been to a World Series.
Yeah,
it was the beginning of the Showalter curse. Leaves a team, they go to the World Series. Leaves a team, go to the World Series.
That's Showalter's MO.
So the Orioles next year, your 2019 World Series champs.
That's a good one. That would be an amazing curse if that actually does happen.
Maybe 2023.
They obviously took the way instead of going that route and playing the Clueless Joe aspect of the hiring, they went a different route and played to the fact that Torre has all the roots in New York, and you know he's back in the neighborhood, and everybody's excited about it. And then they went more into his family, obviously, to give more of the backstory of Joe Torre. And I mean, if you remember, Brian, you certainly do. Like you said, we're around the same age. The storyline during that time was the sister, being a nun. You hear about the heart issues with his brother. Like, those were all very, very prevalent in that 96, towards the end of the 96 series. So his family actually was really involved with that whole team.
Now, did you guys realize that you could find out if someone has an aneurysm just by shaking their hand?
I put that in the notes there. So how much did they exaggerate that?
Oh, well, that was their big dramatic scene for David Cone, for sure.
Right. He shakes his hand. Cone comes off the mound after pitching like 7 shutout innings or whatever. Joe Torre shakes his hand and it's ice cold. And that's how he figured out he had an aneurysm.
He figured out someone was, did he call the aneurysm or did he call it there was something going on? I don't know.
Something wrong.
I still have a very difficult time believing there was an ice cold hand after still pitching that many innings in a game. Even if you have no feeling in your hand, probably not going to be cold. But that whole exchange was interesting. And again, when you look back, when I'm looking at this movie as a whole, I say this, right? Like, the storyline itself was about something that we all love. And it took you back through that. So that was, like, to me, the saving grace of this movie, because I had fun reliving what happened. While it was a horrible rendition of what happened, I played it back in my own mind. And like, they did, that team went through a lot in that year. And Torre went through a lot in that year. I didn't know that he had a kid that late in his life that year.
56
I don't remember
old,
that.
Popping out kids at 56.
Yeah, I didn't remember that part of it. But there were a lot of things that happened during that year that they either dealt with and, you know, got over, and then, came out on top. So there was a lot of things that I think that I had forgotten, little details that made this movie okay in my eyes for that reason.
His brother Rocco dying was sort of forgotten. At least I forgot it, because I had always known about his brother getting the heart transplant towards the World Series, but I forgot that Rocco died earlier in the season.
How old is his kid? His kid's like 22 now, right?
Well, he was born in 95, 96.
Yeah, 96. We should get him on the show.
He'd be a catching prospect. Torre is a good catcher.
Yeah, we should see how young Torre is developing in his adolescence. See what's going on there. I'll look that up. We'll get.
Are we confirmed it was a boy?
No, actually. No, I think it was a girl, actually.
Actually, I want to say he did have a daughter, yeah.
Yeah, because there was a scene. Oh, yeah. So a couple scenes here. that I had some that were very confusing to me.
Just
one,
a couple?
Yeah, yeah. So yeah, I'll name three that I think need to be discussed. One, the Doc Gooden shower scene. Yeah.
That was the worst scene in the whole movie.
Like, what in the God's name is happening here? What made this okay for someone to say, this is what we should do? Doc Gooden is going to be in the shower, the team shower, practicing his mechanics in the shower while all the other guys are like swooned over together over like a railing watching him. His mechanics, like, for an extended period of time,
you're liable to slip.
It's just weird. Like, the whole thing was just a very strange scene. That was the first one.
Well, they had to set up the no-hitter. They had to set up the whole storyline with his dad being sick and then Doc going out there pitching the no-hitter.
So let's set it up in the shower. Before we get into that one, the other place,
what better place? Showers.
Than a team shower. It's bonding.
You're vulnerable. You're naked. Yeah. You do a lot of thinking in the shower.
A lot of emotions are happening.
Breaking down all of your
emotions
mechanics
ran
right
high for Doc there.
It's where I practiced my singing. It's where Doc practices his pitching.
Yes.
It makes sense.
Yes.
So the other one was the handoff between the sister and the brother of the phone from the balcony. I don't know if any of you caught this, but from the balcony to where he was sitting, it looked like down in a sunken room, but it would look like it was on the first floor. She was talking and then handed him the phone and he just grabbed it. Like, it was like they were like 2 feet apart, but they were actually a floor away from each other.
Frank Torrey's 8'6".
I mean, he has to be. He has to be at least 12 feet tall for him to make the exchange that it was baffling.
So that's a minor like movie issue you have.
It killed me.
Okay. What was the third?
The third one was when he got home from a long road trip and he opens the door to the baby, wakes the baby up. The baby practically waves to him, opens the door for the baby.
The baby says, who closed tonight, Dad? The baby's already talking at 4 months
Dad, why'd you open the door and wake me up? And then he goes into his bedroom and the wife's there with the lights on. He's like, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to wake you up. The lights are on. It's obviously she's not sleeping, really. It's all flawed. I can't handle
spoken like a newborn father, for sure.
I can't handle the lack of details. It's such a epic flick.
So you're spot on. They obviously did not hire a production assistant, especially one associated with sports in any way, or maybe even with baseball. They wanted to strike on the Joe Torre story, which was an amazing story, as we've preached already and people already know. But the little things, like you said, you know, there's little things. I think we all had them in the notes. The brawl in Seattle, they had outdoors.
Yes. Thank you. That pissed me off. So it was in Seattle and they have an outdoor stadium. It's a freaking kingdom. How do you fuck that up?
Sorry,
Brian. I don't know if you can swear on your podcast.
No, we're good on
it. We can bleep it.
We're about the same as you guys, where you throw one in maybe an episode. The other one that got me, and I know I'm sure plenty of Yankee fans or older Yankee fans were upset, was seeing number 15 worn on a jersey.
And 42.
Mm-hmm.
With a white guy, right?
42 was a white guy was wearing 42.
There were just a lot of details that were completely missed.
15. I didn't catch the 15. So someone was wearing Thurman Munson's jersey.
Yeah,
that's bad.
Yeah, I actually
Thurman, I saw 15, and then I saw an outfielder was wearing number 46, which at the time was Pettit, and he was a pitcher, so obviously he wasn't playing the outfield. Unless I missed a game. Was there a game where Pettit played right field? Real quick.
There was not.
Oh, okay. After Paulie punched a cooler, they were like, Andy, can you get out there?
So they obviously had John Sterling and Michael Kay reenacting their calls, correct?
Some of those calls were the original calls. I don't remember which ones were reenacted. They had other people calling.
Okay,
as well.
So
were not
did
John
they
Sterling.
Have impersonators?
I think they did for some of them. It was confusing because some of them were, I think, the original calls. And then there were other people. There were calls that were not either one of them. I don't think it was them reenacting. I think it was people trying to reenact the call.
So that's what I thought too. Michael Kay usually sounded like Michael Kay, but there were a couple points where I thought it was a Sterling impersonator.
I think so. But they did have Sterling on for a couple. I definitely heard Sterling a couple times. But obviously, you know, maybe there wasn't a clean clip on certain areas or whatever the case. They had definitely someone else trying to do that. It was very confusing. That's what I'll say in general of this movie. It was a confusing movie in some aspects. If you know the Yankees and you know what actually happened and you know some of these characters, it was confusing.
Well, the thing with this, though. like, you got to know your audience. So they're making a movie about Joe Torre. It's about his life growing up, the struggles he went through and overcame to win the World Series. 90% of those people are going to be baseball fans. Maybe not Yankee fans, but baseball fans that are watching that movie. Like, some random person who doesn't care about baseball is not going to watch that movie, even if it comes on Showtime. Like, they're going to switch the channel. So how do you not fact check this stuff? How do you not make sure you get these facts right?
Because podcasts hadn't been invented yet, and they didn't think that anybody would be breaking down their film like we are right now.
Do you think we're the only people to ever break down this film?
We may. Possibly. That's about
possibly. You know what I said to Scott last night? I was like, there's some analytics nerd in Amazon being like, three people randomly at the same time have watched Joe Torre curveballs along the way. What is going on? And now they're about to have, like, hopefully many more people be like, I got to see this thing.
Yeah. And to be fair, the Brian, you were talking about the IMDb stars, and it didn't even get to Rotten Tomatoes. Is that right? It did have 5 stars on Amazon, and then I went look back and at the rating, I'm like, how it was 2 people, and that's as far as I got. I didn't see if there was a written review or whatever, but there were multiple stars on there, and I saw that. I'm like, oh, what is this? I've never heard of this. This must be something. No.
Was it Joe and Ali Torre?
I think it was. I think it was the Torre daughter that
it was went the on. 22-year-old Torre daughter.
They captured and her birth perfectly.
Yeah, and her college roommate were the ones that reviewed this.
Bottom line for this film, folks, it's 95 minutes long. If you do enjoy baseball, if you're a big Yankee fan, like a lot of you listeners probably are, you want to get a little nostalgic and turn your brain off and just kind of enjoy a rehashing of the story of A, Joe Torre's story, A, the 96 season. You really want to see Wade Boggs on that horse again. This is a movie worth watching. If you want to sit here and break down all the little things like we are right now and pick it apart, you're going to hate the heck out of the film for sure.
Or you'll love it because you'll see it as a comedy.
Yes.
And you know,
yes.
actually see this movie for what it was, a very flawed rendition of the history. And by the way, Wade Boggs was not wearing the helmet on the reenactment either. Also pissed me off.
And they even were filtering in so much real footage throughout the entire thing, especially towards the end. I feel like the last 20 minutes of the movie, 10 minutes of it were actual footage.
Some of it was, some of it wasn't, some of it was, some of it wasn't. It was confusing. Again, like, you're going to the real, I'm like, that when they're showing some of the scenes, they did do some of the acting, like, obviously the Paul O'Neill, which I also laughed out loud and rewound 3 times so that I could watch it, because I thought it was one of the funniest things I've ever seen. My wife had to look up the, by the way, my wife was watching this movie along with me as well. And I will say this, she enjoyed it. And probably because she likes, like, cheesy Lifetime movies as well.
This was exactly a very Lifetime-y movie. That's a good call by Ben.
That's pretty much what it was. It was not like, it was a very low budget, cheesy rendition. And was the other thing about it, it was from 97. So you're looking at this stuff and you're seeing like the smoky flashback scenes. Like, that's what tells you that it's a flashback. And so you have to take, I think, into the time frame of when it was done. And, bad movies at that point, we're very like that. A lot of them were very much like this. The difference is that we all know the details, and we're
too close to the situation to be analyzing a movie like this.
Yeah,
and it's like, exactly, when they filmed, like you said, they mixed in, they went back and forth between real footage and reenacted footage. It's like Oliver Stone's JFK, like, what's real, what's not real. It confuses the viewer.
You can see the pitch in the studio when they pitch that. We're going to have Torre come in, and then there'll be Torre, and then he'll talk to camera, explain some baseball stuff to help people on the way. Then we're going to integrate. We're going to have the actual radio announcer's call overlaying the scene as we're watching this, and then we're going to have actual footage back and forth as you go along. You can almost see the pitch working in studio, but then when you actually put it on film, it obviously, in our opinions, didn't play out.
Yeah. Execution certainly was missed, I'd say. Released
October 17th of 97. So we'd have to check our dates.
A year later. That's like a year later, basically. Every year after the Yankees lost to the Indians in the 97 playoffs, and they're like, all right, they're going to be pissed off. Let's hit them with this movie. It'll cheer them up.
I think they lost to the Indians on the 15th, and they said, let's cheer them up and make a movie in 2 days.
Nice.
And that's what they did.
Yeah, I think it was all put together in 48 hours.
So they called Servino and said, can we make a movie real quick tomorrow and put this out to cheer up the Yankee fans?
Right. It was like everyone was going through this movie like it was the table read. That was the first time they were reading these lines.
I like that. If they did that, then I'm okay with it. Because they were just like, who's in New York right now? Let's cast them. Who's in New York? All these people are in New York. Perfect. They're perfect. That guy's Wade Boggs. Never swung a bat. Never done anything athletic in his life. Perfect.
I might watch the A-Rod documentary a second time. I am not watching this a second time.
Agreed. I think this was my second time rewatching it just for this homework, just so we could chat about it. And I'm good. I'm good with two.
We're encouraging everybody out there to go watch it.
Again, I think it's one of those ones you can look at with a grain of salt and watch. And now that you know our feelings on it too, I think it's a humorous way to pass time, you know, and then also relive for your own sake the 96 season in the championship. So that's my takeaway. Like, that's why I'm not mad that I watched it, because it was about a great year and a great team. And the storyline is exactly, you know, we knew the storyline. And then you get some good things about Torrey, obviously, which are good to know. So
your wives will love it.
Exactly. Your wives will love it.
And your son.
And my 1-year-old son just claps at everything. If someone's clapping on the TV,
so
he claps.
This is really a niche audience we're going for. As long as the guy is a fan of the Yankees and they're married with a 1-year-old, then it's really that's their target demographic.
And their wife likes Lifetime movies, bad Lifetime movies. I don't know if there's good Lifetime movies, but bad Lifetime movies specifically.
I have not seen a good Lifetime movie.
There you go.
Oh, bite your tongue. Hey, during Christmas season? Are you serious?
Yeah. There's some classics, Andrew. Come on. Get with it.
To go check it out.
All right. That's going to wrap up our Joe Torrey curveballs along the way. Take Two podcast listeners, if you're baseball fans just in general, please jump over to the Bronx Pinstripe Show and check them out, because these boys are very well knowledgeable with the Yankees, but they also do talk actual baseball every now and then. And occasionally during football season, they'll even talk football, although I don't agree with either of their football fandoms. But check out the Bronx Pinstripe Show. You can find them on iTunes and all of your other podcasting platforms. Gentlemen, thanks for jumping on. I hope to get you back on and talk maybe some better baseball movies along the way.
Yeah, Brian, thanks, man. It was a lot of fun. And even the bad ones, I still enjoy breaking them down.
I think I agree. I think that baseball and boxing makes the two best sports movies. So there's a lot of baseball movies that are actually worth our time that we can go through. And would love to come back and talk about it. Thanks again.
If I can give a quick teaser too. We had thrown out there watching The Babe, and I did rewatch that.
And
I'm mad at both of you that we were not reviewing that, because I had to watch that garbage right now.
Okay,
that's why I was kind of putting my foot down on that one. That one I remember that one being really bad, and the fact that I hadn't seen this Torrey one, I'm like, maybe it's bad, but I haven't seen it yet. So you know, that's where that was my input on that one.
I do love John Goodman, but not enough to rewatch The Babe.
Awesome. I watched. It was horrible.
All right.
Thanks, gentlemen.
Hey, guys. Thanks for listening to the Bronx Pinstripe Show. Make sure you find us on iTunes and subscribe so you can get all new episodes directly onto your phone. If you do like the show, we'd love for you to take a minute and give us a 5-star rating and review in iTunes. It really helps us out and allows us to create more shows. We're on Twitter at Bronx Pinstripes and the same on Facebook. You can always find us there talking Yankee baseball. Thanks again, guys, for your support. Really appreciate it. And go Yankees.